Today we have our final sermon in the book of Ruth, in Ruth chapter 4. You can go ahead and open your Bibles there. But before we get started, I'll let you know what's coming up. The next two Sundays, I'll be out of the pulpit, and we will return to our side quest series in the book of James. And Blake and then Dick will be preaching to the next two passages in James. And then in the fall, I wanted to let you know what I'll be starting, and it'll be a series on the biblical covenants. So looking at the big moments in Scripture where God sets forth his covenant and how that unfolds the big picture story of the Bible. So we'll have a sermon on Adam, on Noah, on Abraham, on Israel, on David, and then we'll have a sermon on the new covenant promised in the Old Testament, and then a sermon on the new covenant inaugurated in the New Testament. So that's what will be coming up, preaching schedule-wise, in the fall. Now, there are moments in stories when you realize what has actually been going on. You realize that this story has been told, and you've felt the drama of it unfolding. You've come to care about these individuals in this story, but there's been breadcrumbs that has led to the climax at the end, and you learn that it's not just about random individuals, but that this story has epic proportions. Now, I intended to illustrate this from Andrew Peterson's book, The Edge of the Dark Sea of Darkness, the first in the Wing Feather series. He actually wrote the song we just sang. Is he worthy, Andrew Peterson? But I realized that if I illustrate it to you from that story, those of you who have not read it will just sort of be following along with a story you don't understand, and I will spoil the book for you. But those of you who have read it, think of that moment at the end of that book. You'll know what I'm talking about. We're coming to the end of the book of Ruth, and it's a brilliantly written book, and we have been sucked in to caring about these characters. But here at the end of the book, we're going to get a glimpse of the bigger picture. And it's more important of a story than we had previously realized. So let's read Ruth chapter 4. Boaz went to the gates of the town and sat down there. Soon the family redeemer Boaz had spoken about came by. Boaz said, "Come over here and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Then Boaz took 10 men of the town elders and said, "Sit here." And they sat down. He said to the redeemer, "Naomi, who has returned from the territory of Moab, is selling the portion of the field that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should inform you. Buy it back in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you want to redeem it, do it. But if you do not want to redeem it, tell me so that I will know, because there isn't anyone other than you to redeem it, and I am next after you." "I want to redeem it," he answered. Then Boaz said, "On the day you buy the field from Naomi, you will acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the deceased man, to perpetuate the man's name on his property." The redeemer replied, "I can't redeem it myself, or I will ruin my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption, because I can't redeem it." At an earlier period in Israel, a man removed his sandal and gave it to the other party in order to make any matter legally binding concerning the right of redemption or the exchange of property. This was the method of legally binding a transaction in Israel. So the redeemer removed his sandal and said to Boaz, "Buy back the property yourself." Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I am buying from Naomi everything that belonged to Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife to perpetuate the deceased man's name on his property so that his name will not disappear among his relatives or from the gate of his hometown. You are witnesses today." All the people who were at the city gate, including the elders, said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is entering your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built the house of Israel. May you be powerful in Ephrathah and your name well known in Bethlehem. May your house become like the house of Perez, the son of Tamar, bore to Judah because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman. Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. He slept with her, and the Lord granted conception to her, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you without a family redeemer. May his name become well known in Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Indeed, your daughter-in-law, who loves you, is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Naomi took the child, placed him on her lap, and became a mother to him. The neighbor woman said, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the family records of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. This is God's holy and inspired word. Thanks be to God. This passage is broken up into two scenes and an epilogue for the book. So scene one covers verses 1 through 12. The scene is titled Boaz versus Mr. So-and-so. Boaz is an excellent character in the book of Ruth. We are introduced to him at the beginning of chapter 2, and the narrator told us that he was a prominent man of noble character. And in chapter 2, he lived up to that high introduction. He provided and protected Ruth. But chapter 2 ends with this tension of, well, the harvest season is going to end, and will Boaz's protection and provision for Ruth and Naomi end at that point as well? So that was the tension that we dealt with last week in chapter 3, where Ruth went to the threshing floor and essentially proposed to Boaz. And Boaz said yes, he'd like to redeem Ruth, but that then introduced the tension for chapter 4. That tension was this closer family redeemer had first dibs on marrying Ruth. And so solving this problem is now the capstone to our introduction of Boaz as a character in this story. We ended chapter 3 with Naomi asserting her trust in Boaz. She said that Boaz will not rest until he takes care of this. And that's exactly what that happens. As this begins, that this chapter 4 begins that very same morning. So that morning from the threshing floor, Ruth goes off, and then Boaz goes and sits at the city gates. And this city gates is not just a random place. This is where business is done. This is the town square or even the courthouse. So Boaz went to the gate of the town and sat down. Soon the family redeemer he had spoken about came by. Boaz sits, and soon the guy comes. Elsewhere, this word translated soon is translated behold. Boaz sits, and behold, here comes the guy he was looking for. So this is another one of those moments where the narrator is pinging us that God is up to something, just like the moment when Ruth just so happened to walk into Boaz's field. God's hidden hand of providence remains in this story. Then the second half of verse 4, Boaz said, "Come over here and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Now, do you see that footnote? If you're looking at the CSB, there's a footnote, a translation footnote for that first sentence. And the translation footnote says, "Come over here, Mr. So-and-so." And I think what happened is the translators for the CSB wanted to put Mr. So-and-so in the translation, but they weren't brave enough because they knew they were going to be made fun of by like the ESV or the NASB would be laughing at them. That's the unserious translation for saying Mr. So-and-so in the Bible. But they should have been brave, because the word that that Boaz says here is this phrase that is used twice else in the Old Testament. And each time, of the other times it's used in the Old Testament, it's translated such and such a place. In other words, it's a word for saying the name when you don't want to say what the name is. It's Mr. So-and-so. That's the only English equivalent that we have for what is said here. In other words, there's a reason why this redeemer, this non-redeemer, his name is not shared in this story. And we'll get to why that is. The narrator, the author is doing something with that. So verse 2, then Boaz took 10 men of the town's elders and said, sit here, and they sat down. Okay, so all this to say is that Boaz has convened court. He's got official business that he needs to settle between he and Mr. So-and-so. And Boaz shows this planning, this foresight to gather everyone who needs to be gathered and be proactive about solving this problem. He knows what he wants. He sets a plan to figure out how to get there, and then he follows through. So Boaz tells Mr. So-and-so, verse 3, he says, Naomi, who has returned from the territory of Moab, is selling the portion of her field that belongs to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should inform you, buy it back in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you want to redeem it, do it. But if you do not want to redeem it, tell me so that I will know, because there isn't anyone other than you to redeem it, and I am next after you. So Boaz is pressuring Mr. So-and-so to take action, some action. And he gives him sort of two valid paths of action that are going to be honorable for him in the situation. He can honorably do the thing of redeem the land, or he could honorably say, I'm not going to be the redeemer, and give that duty to Boaz. So Boaz is setting him up to be able to have an honorable way to do either of those things. And the redemption that is mentioned here, remember last week I talked about the four categories of redemption, and you can see that what Boaz is bringing up is that land redemption category. So we don't know exactly what happened, but it seems likely that before Elimelech left Israel, he was one of those impoverished Israelites who sold his own land in order to try to make it. And so he gave away that land, sold that land, and now it's up to the kinsman redeemer to purchase back that land from the person who'd sold it to and bring it back into the proper family in order for that inheritance to make it down the generations in Israel. And so when it says Naomi is selling the land, it's not quite right, but we don't really have a word for what this would be in English. It's that Naomi is needing a kinsman redeemer to purchase her land, to buy this land. She's not going to get any money out of it, but it's going to be that whoever's owning it temporarily. So Boaz says this to Mr. So-and-so, and to our collective horror, we kind of gasp and hear that he says that he will redeem it. And we're saying, wait, Boaz, this would be such a letdown if after all of this, Mr. So-and-so gets to marry Ruth. But don't worry, Boaz has a plan. Boaz is on to it. Look at verse 5. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from Naomi, you will acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the deceased man, to perpetuate the man's name on his property. Ah, okay, so it's not just the one aspect of redemption in play here. There's also the other aspect of redemption, the marry the widow thing. So Boaz is sort of, you also have to do the marrying the widow aspect of redemption here. And bringing this all out in front of the elders and all these witnesses, it really is going to put this guy in a position where honorably he can either do the full right thing, or he can do a similarly honorable thing and just give the full rights to Boaz. And What's he say? He says, I can't redeem it myself. Well, I'll ruin my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption because I can't redeem it. Yay! It worked. So this final hurdle has been overcome. So we don't know if maybe it was he already had kids and he didn't want to ruin the inheritance that he would be giving his own kids. Not sure what's going on in the background of his objection, but he does this ritual with the sandal that the narrator explains to us what it means. And okay, hold a sandal, that makes it official. And he buys back the property himself. Okay, so we see here really a wisdom and a shrewdness to Boaz. So he has this initiative and foresight. He knows what the tipping point will be for Mr. So-and-so. And he drove towards clarity to getting the official answer with the right people there needed to get the answer. And he was prepared for that beforehand. So all of that to say, I hope that there's something here of Boaz, of his wisdom and his shrewdness and his effectiveness in leadership that we can take hold of. Or at least we can acknowledge that effectiveness in leadership is by no means anti-Christian. Christians can and should be good at knowing what we want, at seeing the obstacle, at making a plan to overcome the obstacle and obtaining that goal. This shrewdness that Boaz shows is a part of the building up of his good character in the book. This is not a strike against him by any means. So, continue on, verse 9. Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today, and I am buying from Naomi everything that belonged to Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife to perpetuate the deceased man's name on his property so that his name will not disappear among his relatives or from the gate of his hometown. You are witnesses today. So he begins and ends this little speech by pointing out these witnesses. You are witnesses today. And this little addition is important to remember Boaz's timeliness in dealing with this thing, just like he had promised, I'll deal with this this morning. And here it is today. He's dealing with this. And this is the day he's promised. He's fulfilling his promises. And we see that Naomi was right. He's fulfilling his word. And it's interesting to compare Mr. So-and-so with Boaz here. So on the one hand, Mr. So-and-so, he does nothing wrong. He is compared to Boaz here, though he certainly doesn't look all that great. So Mr. So-and-so is passive in this story. He hadn't done anything about Ruth and Naomi up until this point. And now when pressured, he says he'll redeem the land, but then no, he won't because he doesn't want to marry Ruth. He doesn't want to mess up his inheritance. He doesn't want to mess up the continuation of his family name on his family land. But somehow or another, comparing him to Boaz really makes Boaz shine and this guy fall flat. Seems that his attempt to preserve his name, to preserve his inheritance, has resulted in him being known forevermore as Mr. So-and-so. And Boaz, in attempting to do good to Ruth and Naomi, is now remembered. And even we look at him and say, wow, that's somebody who we would like to emulate. So another thing that happens in these verses is that for the first time in the story, Boaz starts to raise the bar for what good can happen for Ruth and Naomi. So in chapter one, our sights were really low when we were hopeless with Naomi here. Ruth and Naomi's main goal was not die of starvation. That was the threshold of good that could potentially come in the story. And through chapter two, we're thinking, all right, we can have food. That's the hope that chapter two introduces. And then chapter three, we're thinking redemption. Maybe we can have marriage. Maybe we can have a permanent provision for these women. But now Boaz just raised the bar again. Not just that there would be permanent protection for Ruth and Naomi, but that he, through this union, would be able to perpetuate Elimelech's name. That this family line of Israel, which was nearly at the very precipice of being snuffed out, could be renewed. So the upper end of hope has expanded even higher here. And then in verse 11, the people respond. All the people at the city gate, including the elders, said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is entering your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built the house of Israel. May you be powerful in Ephrathah and your name be well known in Bethlehem. May your house become like the house of Perez, the son of Tamar, born to Judah, because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman. May the Lord give great fruitfulness to this marriage. May Ruth be like Rachel and Leah, who gave birth to the 12 sons who became the 12 tribes of Israel. May Boaz's house be like Perez, who's one of his descendants and who's the central household within the tribe of Judah." So this prayer, it raises the bar yet again. Not just could Elimelech's line not die out, but maybe it could be that this becomes a central, a particularly blessed family line within the nation of Israel. It'd be an extraordinary thing for God to work from where we are at the beginning of the book. Now, there's more good to come. There's more from these elders of Israel. You know, it's interesting. These elders of Israel began to think of them saying this of a Moabitess woman, widow, is really remarkable. Really, the transformation to have this kind of charity, this kind of welcome to this foreigner in this moment, in this time in Israel, is remarkable in itself. And the good things are still coming. So the second scene covers verses 13 through 17. And this is Naomi versus Mara in this scene. So the scene fades, and apparently the transfer of the land went fine. There was a wedding, and now there's going to be a baby. So verse 13, Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. He slept with her, and the Lord granted conception to her, and she gave birth to a son. Now, we've got to stop and realize how astounding this is. It's not simply that there was a marriage and a baby. You remember that Ruth had been married before for upwards of 10 years to Mahlon, and she had not had a child in all that time. So the question is, was God going to intervene and open her womb? Was this barren woman going to have a baby? And yes, it says Yahweh granted conception to her. And in the book of Ruth, God is mentioned a bunch of times, but he's always mentioned by the characters themselves. The narrator has been very subtle in his nods to what God is up to through his work of showing God's providential hand. But this is the first and only place where the narrator comes out with it that Yahweh has done something. God granted conception. God brought life to Ruth's womb. It's God who gives life. And this is good to remember. God can and God does overcome infertility. Every pregnancy is a gift from God. God is the author of life. And it's good for us to remember this so that we don't become functional materialists. Our culture will tell us that pregnancy and everything is merely a matter of biology, that there is no spiritual truth or spiritual director beneath the miracle of conception. And this little verse just reminds us that we live in a God-saturated world. God is behind and beneath all things. So don't fall into the trap of being a functional materialist, but understand that God is beneath and behind all that happens in your life. So next, the narrator turns us in verse 14 to the women of Bethlehem. And the women of Bethlehem form this really interesting character for the book because, you know, they are the ones who responded to Naomi when she declared herself Mara at the end of chapter 1. And now they're this contrast as Naomi is a different person. And here's this character again of these women again. And it's interesting because these women, they almost function similarly to how the chorus functions in a Shakespeare play. So, you know, remember what you think of, you know, about Shakespeare plays. There's the chorus who kind of speaks for the audience, moves the plot along a little bit. The women are kind of functioning like that here. So look at verse 14. The women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the man, blessed be the Lord who has not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name become well known in Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Indeed, your mother-in-law who loves you, your daughter-in-law who loves you, is better to you than seven sons has given birth to him." This is interesting because as they're talking, they keep saying he, and it's a little bit unclear at the beginning who the he is that they're talking about. But then at the end, it makes it clear it's baby Obed that we're talking about. That's the baby that was born. So if we read the sentences in reverse order, it kind of tells us from the, you know, from the end, from the beginning, who it is that they're talking about. So it says, Ruth has given birth to him. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. May his name become well known in Israel. He is your family redeemer. So it seems, I think, that they're actually referring to the child, not Boaz, as the redeemer, which means they're not saying as technical, legal sense of the redeemer, but in a more figurative sense, that this child will be the renewal and the sustenance for Naomi. This child will be the protector and the provider. This child will be her redeemer. And that's a really nice, well-wishing, kind of thing. At least that's probably what it sounded like at the time. But if they really were referring to the child as the redeemer, then something more could be going on here. That this child, or at least this child's child, this child's grandchild, is going to be King David, is going to be a redeemer of the Old Testament's anticipation of Jesus as our great redeemer. So it could be that these women said something far more true, far more profound, far more prophetic than they even realized. Then in verse 16, Naomi took the child and placed him on her lap and became a mother to him. The neighbor women said, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, as if the barrenness to blessed theme isn't clear enough, let's make it even more explicit to us. Naomi, the old embittered woman, Mara's dead. Naomi now has a baby on her lap. And this child is her child. She has become a mother to him. In other words, it's as if God has opened up Naomi's womb itself. It's that God has given Naomi a son. She is a blessed grandmother. So God has done a great work in Naomi's life. And I think he was so kind to her through this book. She was sinfully bitter in chapter 1. She was faithless in her approach to God in chapter 1. She was a cautionary tale for us in chapter 1. And now Mara is gone because God was kind to her and blessed her anyways. It wasn't that she came back to God and said, "Okay, I shouldn't have mistrusted you." It's that God cared abundantly for her in chapter 2 and chapter 3 and now in chapter 4. God blessed her anyway. God blessed her with the hesed love of Ruth. He blessed her with the protection and the provision of Boaz. And at the beginning of 3, Naomi was a different person. At that point, she was ready to take initiative, ready to make a plan, ready to have enough hope to have faith again. And now she's just fully blessed, isn't she? God has brought life where there was only death. And it turns out her daughter-in-law was more to her than 7 sons. Ruth was this conduit of blessing to God, to Naomi. And God was so good to Naomi, not because she defeated Mara herself, but even when Mara was winning the battle for Naomi's soul, God was kind. God's goodness is shining out here in the story of Naomi. And that's the end of the story. Those 2 scenes close the action of the book. But there's a prologue, a very important prologue. So part 3, the prologue, is God's hand revealed. So why is Ruth in the Bible? The story's been really well told. I mean, we've been engrossed in these characters. We're invested in the lives of Ruth and Naomi and Boaz. We can think of it as this historical nonfiction that's really well written. We can think of it as just a kind of an anecdote, a story of God's faithfulness to some individuals. That would be encouraging to us. Yet this is not only that. This is also part of God's grand story of redemption, that there is more at play than provision for these individuals. So here at the very end is the aha moment. The whole time, the story has actually been about protecting the royal line. The narrator clues us in with this just deft economy of words by retelling centuries of history in these 10 names. Now, these are the family records of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed followed Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. Against the backdrop of this spiritually dark time of the judges, this story has shown that a remnant of faithful Israelites existed. Shows us that Boaz was indeed a man of noble character, and God has been the personal refuge for those who cry out to him. He continues his work of his provision hand, his providing hand in their lives. He answers their prayers. And if that was the message of the book, that would be enough for us. We'd have plenty to be encouraged by and reasons to say praise the Lord. But there's more than personal redemption going on. God has been working about national redemption. Remember the refrain of the book of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. It was a time of need in Israel, need for a king, but not just any king, a king God would provide, a king of promise. And when you go back before Judges, we find such a promise. Jacob had 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. And at the end of his life, he blessed and prophesied over each son, which became a prophecy over each tribe. In Genesis 49, we see Jacob's promise concerning Judah. It says this, he says, "Judah, your brothers will praise you. The scepter will not depart from Judah or the staff from between his feet until he whose right it is comes and the obedience of the peoples belong to him." You see, God has promised to provide a king in Judah's line, that he will rule over his brothers with a scepter, and there will be some specific descendant of Judah that's hinted at there, who has the right to demand obedience from the peoples, from the nations. That promise was handed to Judah, and then from Judah it was handed to Perez. And then it seemed to lie dormant as Perez's descendants spread through the tribe of Judah, with foreign nations regularly conquering Israel, with Israel only doing what was right in their own eyes, until the book of Ruth comes. And it shows us that God has been protecting his royal line. So the curtain is pulled back, and we see from God's viewpoint, we see that the royal line has been protected from Perez to Hezron to Ram to Amminadab to Nahshon to Salmon to Boaz to Obed to Jesse to David. The drama of these last four chapters has actually been the drama of God preserving this line, of God moving the story of redeeming Israel forward from Perez down to David. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He was doing so much more than we could ask or think through this book. We've moved from don't starve to find a redeemer, to restore Elimelech's name, to be a great family in Israel, to be the royal line. And even still, we haven't forgotten, we haven't gotten to the heart of the book, if we just end at David. Because the story of David itself doesn't end with David. David's reign fulfilled much of the promise to Judah. All the tribes of Israel did bow to him. He did have that scepter of rule. The peoples, the nations, did obey him. He subdued the surrounding nations. And yet, the climax of David's life is 2 Samuel 7, when God makes a promise to David. He says this, God says this. He says, when your time comes and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up after you, your descendant, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. David's son, Solomon, took the throne. Solomon, coming from David. But Solomon died. He didn't reign forever. And his son Rehoboam took the throne. And not only did Rehoboam die, but the kingdom split in two. No longer were the brothers all coming to him at that point. And so through the rest of Old Testament history, this promise seems lost. It seems forgotten. It seems impossible. It seems that the hope had gone out, that this family line was in need of resurrection. Until God created life in a womb that had no natural reason to have life in it. And that son was raised by a father named Joseph, who was in the line of David. So Jesus came, the son of David, to be the greater David who was promised, the king who would sit on a greater throne than David's and who would reign forever. And he came and preached his gospel. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And after Jesus' death and resurrection, he commissioned his disciples saying this, all authority on heaven and on earth has been given to me. All authority. He's declaring his reign, his rule over it all. And in establishing his authority, he commissioned his disciples to do his work, to go to the nations with this message of the gospel, to make disciples and baptize them in the name of this triune God. And with that, Jesus ascended to be with the Father, and he sent his Holy Spirit to empower the disciples for this work. And so we as Spirit-empowered Christians, we as his commissioned local church, we are on this mission. We come under King Jesus and do as he has told us. We operate on his authority as his embassy to his kingdom. Now, all of this means that being a Christian, that being this church, God has brought this to pass. And part of what God did to bring us here was through a man named Boaz and a woman named Ruth. Even when things looked completely dark and God felt far away, God worked his plan of redemption. God worked in human history to provide us our eternal king. So, how do we live in light of this? Let me offer you three closing applications. Number one, live righteously within God's mysterious providence. Live righteously within God's mysterious providence. When we look back at Ruth, God's mysterious hand of providence is now revealed. Yet they had to live through that drama and the tension in real time. They had to take risks. They had to be bold. They had to have hope. They had to be righteous. We don't know everything. There's plenty of mystery of God's providence in the here and now, but that's okay. We have enough to live righteously. We know enough to be men and women of noble character. We know enough that we should be proactive and planning and risk-taking and bold and hopeful. And this is all possible because we trust God. Amidst the mystery of what he's up to, we can trust him because we know him. Second application, because God is sovereign, put off anxiety. Because God is sovereign, put off anxiety. This is a corollary to this boldness and righteousness I just talked about. We live in this age where anxiety is in the air. We tend to let fear rule our hearts. And so we face those fears. We need to discipline our minds to come back to the truth of God's sovereignty. Oftentimes, we need to remind ourselves of the biblical truth in its straightforward propositional way. We need to remind ourselves that we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. We need to remember that. That's a glorious propositional truth. Cling to that with all your might. But here in Ruth is that same truth told to us in a story form. We can meditate on this story, meditate on the truth that is lived out and illustrated through this story. God doesn't only speak to us in propositional truths, but in poetry and in story as well. So remember, God graciously turned Naomi from being Mara to being Naomi. Remember, Ruth just so happened to go into Boaz's field. Remember that God protected his royal line. So as you fight anxiety, cast your mind to the riches of the story of Ruth. Third and finally, worship King Jesus. We are his citizens. We are his subjects, his people, or even his bride. Your life exists for his glory. So enjoy him. Revel in him. Celebrate him. Worship him in all things at all times. Amen. Let's take a moment of silence to consider this passage.